Hello, and welcome to episode 91 of the Sugar Mamas podcast. Today, you are in for another awesome episode with me and Joanne Robb. Remember, Joanne is a psychotherapist. She has her own therapy practice in the state of California, but she also offers coaching courses and webinars for parents and caregivers of type 1 diabetics nationwide. Joanne also has a fabulous podcast called Sweet Talk for Parents of Kids with Type 1 Diabetes. And if you would like to have your personal diabetes questions answered by Joanne, you can visit her website at diabetessweettalk.com. Click on the dark purple banner at the top of the page and submit your question. If you're going through a struggle and you really need some help, giving your question to Joanne and being a guest on her podcast, even if it's done anonymously, is like being part of a little mini therapy session. And we all need those every once in a while. Be sure to check it out. I will leave a link in the show notes. Today's topic with Joanne is on relationships and the stressors that come with a type 1 diabetes diagnosis. It is no secret that having a child with type 1 diabetes can put some stress on your most valued and precious relationships with your spouse, with other family members, and even with friends. Listen in today as Joanne and I talk through some of those situations and try to offer some nuggets of wisdom for you to apply in real life. Okay, without further ado, let's get started. You're listening to the Sugar Mamas Podcast, a show designed for moms and caregivers of type 1 diabetics. Here you'll find a community of like-minded people who are striving daily to keep their kids safe, happy, and healthy in the ever-changing world of type 1. I'm your host and fellow T1D mom, Katie Roseborough. Enjoy! Before we get started, I need you to know that nothing you hear on the Sugar Mamas podcast should be considered medical advice. Please be safe, be smart, and always consult your physician before making changes to the way you manage type 1 diabetes. Thanks. I am back with Joanne Robb today, and Joanne and I are going to talk about a pretty big topic, pretty broad topic that we could really probably spend several episodes dissecting this situation. But, and who knows, maybe in the future we'll kind of break it down a little bit more. But today's topic is relationships and just the stress and strain that can be put on different relationships in your life when a type 1 diabetes diagnosis enters your world. You know, and that can show up in lots of different ways. We're going to kind of run through the different relationships, you know, between spouses, between you and your type 1 diabetic child, between you and your adult friends, even between, you know, your child and maybe their friends, because those relationships can shift too. You know, it, in my head, I'm also thinking about relationships with, like, you know, other family members. I mean, even mm-hmm. with just aunts and uncles and grandparents. I mean, all of that can get shifted, and it can just be stressful trying to navigate kind of the new normal with all of it.
I agree.
Yeah. I'm curious to, I mean, I know you don't have a percentage that you can give me, but do you feel like when you go through the coaching courses with parents and caregivers, is that a lot of what you're talking about, or do you find that comes up a lot?
With parents who are newer to diagnosis, so I have a course called After Diagnosis that's for parents in the first year after diagnosis. And with those parents, I feel like it's louder. And what's louder is the feeling of, I can't ask for help, and my relationships have completely shifted because of this. Like, I hear a lot, actually, which makes me very sad. I hear a lot from moms who are saying that their mothers are not the support that they need and expected, right? Because their mothers are anxious about doing management. I also, for sure, hear stories of parents whose parents are amazing support, right? But I do hear a lot about moms of young kids who suddenly got a diagnosis and their parents or the grandparents are just not getting involved in the way they had hoped. And that's a particularly painful narrative. But I think when you're right into diagnosis, the shift in relationships is a little, it throws you off balance. So I definitely hear that more as I get a little further from diagnosis. That's not necessarily the primary presenting issue that I see. And that said, I think there's often a theme for parents of feeling like they can't ask for the help that they need, right? That they're too burdensome, that what they need is too burdensome. And so there's a way that diabetes creeps into relationship in that way.
Yeah, I feel like I personally don't have an issue asking for help when I need it from grandparents or like my sister or even friends. What I struggle with is I'm already derailing the conversation, Joanne. This is not That's a good okay. sign. But no, I struggle with I struggle with how much information do I give somebody, because it's like, if it's a good friend of mine, I can kind of, I've already said humor is my coping mechanism. I can kind of joke around with them about like, okay, this is like not serious at all, but also like super serious. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I need you to be paying attention. But yeah, like just like every school year, I struggle with, well, how much do I really want to tell these teachers? Like, I don't want to freak them out. I don't want them to feel, I want to communicate that this is very important, but also not, I don't want it to be a huge burden in their life. So anyway, that's a struggle.
Yeah. I think that that's a really common struggle. And I remember at one point thinking, when will I not introduce myself where the first thing pretty much that I'm letting people know is that I have kids with type 1 diabetes? And that, I feel like just recently. So because it really is so identifying, and I needed people to understand that my experience was different than their experience in whatever ways I needed to communicate that. But Katie, what you just said is also important. There's that balance between letting folks know that it's important and they need to pay attention. And then the words that you next said were, and I don't want to burden them. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing I hear from almost all parents, like even from you feeling totally entitled and in strong enough relationship that you can take up space. There's mm-hmm. a way that type 1 parents feel like, and you're talking about it with teachers, right, who aren't the people you're emotionally close to. It's somebody you have to kind of be like, and actually, I need you to help with this thing. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky because we do often feel burdensome. Like that is a word I hear all the time.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I hate it. I would like to not feel that way, but I feel like it's a little bit inevitable. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about marriages or just relationship partners, spouses, people that are kind of doing life together. And then all of a sudden their child gets diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I've seen lots and lots and lots of people that are very, very sad and stressed out because they do not agree with their spouse on how things should be managed. One person usually feels like, they should be logging every single thing and, be extremely, extremely on top of it all the time, 24/7. And the other person is trying to create a little space between themselves and diabetes, or one person thinks they should do low carb and the other person doesn't care about that, So what's your best suggestions for just partners that are not seeing eye to eye with whatever the diabetes situation might be? Mm-hmm. This is such a triggering thing for a lot of people.
Yes, it is. Okay. The notes I wanted to look at are, I've done a bunch of free webinars that I've developed, and I was thinking of developing one on, parent relationship in managing diabetes. And I'm actually a certified couples therapist. And I was talking to my consultant about it once and took a ton. And he's like, why do you think you don't know what to say? And he's like, here are all the things. I'm like, oh, yes, of course, I do know what to say. But it's tricky, right? It is a really tricky thing. What I want to say is, the way I think about this is, like, as a couples therapist, when a couple comes into my office and they're having conflict, what I'm looking for is what we call the cycle. So the content really almost doesn't matter, right? Because if you have a fight with your spouse, Katie, which I'm sure you do because we're all married, we all fight with our spouses, right?
Yes.
The content changes, but the way the fight looks and the way it feels inside you and probably inside your partner is the same, no matter what the content is. And so diabetes, in my view, sits on wherever the fault line is in the family. So if the fault line is between you and your spouse, that you really see things differently, that is exactly where diabetes is going to sit. If the fault line is between you and your kid, right, you have like a, quote, identified patient child in your family, when diabetes comes, that's where it's going to sit. If the fault line is around your relationship to food, that's where diabetes is going to sit. So I'm not saying it only sits in one place, but I think that wherever the family structure has the least integrity, and I mean that structurally, not like you don't have integrity as a person or the relationship, but where there's like a crack in the armor, basically a chink, that's where diabetes is going to sit. Mm-hmm. So in answer to your question, it's a little hard to answer because I need to see what the cycle is between those two people, right? Because diabetes is sitting wherever that cycle is, and it really can vary, but family to family. That said, the important remedy is curiosity. like, where is your partner coming from? The challenge here is often when we get in conflict with our partners, we feel massively dysregulated on the inside. So it's hard to like stand down and be your best self when you're already so dysregulated, right? That's what makes the conflict. But the question is, what's the other person's perspective? Like, if you assume that we all love our children and we're all coming from our best possible place, why is it different for them? What are they thinking differently? And can they hear from you how you're thinking differently from them? Can you kind of navigate your way to some compromise? Mm-hmm. I also think that at the beginning, right, post-diagnosis, parents are really anxious. And so their logging everything is a sign of their anxiety and their incredible desire to get it perfectly right so they keep their children as safe as possible. Not without recognition in that moment that safety is broader than that, right? Like, it's not just getting every number right. It's sort of taking into account all the family dynamics and flexibility. Like, those things create health too. But that's a really common conflict / division of labor that happens really post-diagnosis. And I think everybody just recognizing that you're in a crisis, right? Mm-hmm. It is a crisis. And just giving some breath and space and grace to everyone there, assuming that everyone's doing their best, mm-hmm. right? And getting help if you can't work it out, right? Mm-hmm. It could require some couples therapy as like a quick hit of that if you can't find your way. And I don't know, I don't want to put a timetable, but like 6 months, something like this, where you really have been trying and it's not working. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I know that the times, you know, when I have felt just kind of unsupported in the whole diabetes world, because I do most of the management in our home. Sure. I mean, every now and then I get a little bit resentful about that just because it's exhausting and mm-hmm. I'm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I would love to pass the torch on, but it's just the way it worked out in our family. Like we had always agreed that I would work, but probably never full time. And mm-hmm. then my husband would be the full-time person. And so it just kind of naturally fell on me, which, you know, it's an honor to be caring for her, truly, even though some days I'm very, very tired. But I know that in the times that I have felt like I needed more support, it's never a good thing if I am stuffing and stuffing and stuffing.
Yes.
And then everything just explodes all at once. Yep. It's best. And it's also not good for me to just come with a very broad plea of I need more help. Like, it's better for me to come to the table with specific things I need. Yep. Help with, like, hey, yep. I really would appreciate it if you did the Dexcom change tonight. I just need a break or yep. something along those yep. lines. Or hey, if the alarms go off tonight, can you be the one to get up and take care of it? And mm-hmm. and that is helpful for us, I think, just to mm-hmm. kind of know where exactly I need help.
You know? So you're talking about two different things and they're both really mm-hmm. important. Okay. The first thing, I just revised that, is that you're talking about trying to stay inside your, I call it a window of tolerance, mm-hmm. right? You're trying to not get so dysregulated that you're erupting, right? And mm-hmm. that happens, especially with the primary diabetes caregiver, right? You're overwhelmed, you're overtired. Mm-hmm. And then there's this feeling of like, I have to do it. And so you keep stuffing down all the little messages that you're getting that it's actually too much now and you need some kind of break or some kind of support that gets stuffed. And then there's an eruption, right? So you're mm-hmm. talking about how you're noticing, very good, that you need to stay inside your window of tolerance, because if you get out of there, it causes more conflict. The mm-hmm. other thing you're talking about that I think is beautiful and totally right on is that you're making specific asks instead of just saying, I need help, I'm overwhelmed, which mm-hmm. you can say that, but mm-hmm. you could say, I'm feeling really overwhelmed. I'm really feeling like I'm needing extra help. Would you mind taking on this, this, and this? Because I think that would help me get a little bit of a breath and some air here so that I'm more capable of managing this, right? So it is mm-hmm. about asking for the specific thing. Sometimes when we're dysregulated, it's hard to do. So some of what mm-hmm. we're talking about is trying to catch this earlier, try to not let it go so long that you're mm-hmm. feeling heroic, like, and kind of like the martyr, like, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. And the truth mm-hmm. is, we're not superhuman. This is a very exhausting, kind of relentless disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. I mean, I definitely am a stuffer because I don't like conflict. I don't like conflict within my own personal self, and I don't mm-hmm. like conflict in relationships, which can be very problematic at times. But yeah, that's like my main goal in life is to keep the peace, and I hate conflict. But I've just have come to realize that if I just stuff it all down mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden explode one day, like mm-hmm. that, I feel guilty and shame, you know, because I usually have said something that I probably shouldn't have said and I didn't mean to say. Then my husband is just like kind of like a deer in the headlights. Like, I don't even know what to do with this, because he's like super calm, almost never, ever, ever loses his cool. But, you know, I have just come to recognize that I really need to just make the request before it becomes like a volcano situation where
Yeah. So that's one of the ways that being someone who's conflict avoidant has really served you, is that you're thinking about a strategy to avoid the conflict later in a really helpful way. Some people I think it's Einstein who said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. So it's attributed to Einstein, but that's true. Like, if we think we're going to just keep stuffing it and it'll be better next time, probably not the best strategy, right? So I like that your conflict avoidance is leading you to really think strategically about how to truly avoid it. You're not just turning away from it and saying, it'll be better next time, and ignoring it. You're really thinking strategically. And so that's important too. Like, don't ignore if there's a place that you guys keep getting stuck as a couple. Like, pay attention to it and see if you can figure out other ways to possibly manage it, assuming that it will come up again, because it will. That's what happens.
Yeah. Do you find that most people that you talk to, you know, couples that you're talking to, like, that one person takes on most of the diabetes management? I honestly think that even though I do get very tired sometimes and burned out, like, I honestly think that works best for us, because, you know, it's kind of like there's too many cooks in the kitchen type of situation where lots of people are giving their input and suggestion. And sometimes it's just best for one person to, like, make that decision.
Yeah. I do find that. I also find that it's mostly mothers, not always. And I think there are some families where there's a much clearer division of labor. So there's one family, a parent is in charge of all the body stuff and the other parent is in charge of all the ordering stuff. And if you think about it, that's a huge job, like getting on the phone with insurance and dealing with all the supplies. It's huge. And so if somebody else, like if someone took that off my load, I'd be so, so happy, right? So For the lead parent, I'm putting that in quotes, right? Like, is there a way to divide some of it so that, you know, because Katie, you're right, like having too many people making a decision can be hard, although sometimes helpful to have more brains, but certainly not like on the fly all the time. You know, someone has to be the decision, lead decision maker, but that doesn't mean you need to also order the supplies and be on the phone with Dexcom if there's a technical issue, right? You know, it depends what everyone can carry. But yes, mostly I do see that one parent is the lead parent.
Yes. And I do make my husband, even if I'm not feeling overly stressed with it all, I do make him do some of the device changes, because every now and then, because I'm like, what if I fall off the planet tomorrow? Like, you need to be, you need, every now and then you need to have some practice and how to do these. And my daughter's also getting a lot more independent, and she, you know, she can do it all on her own. She just prefers to not.
Yes. Well, that's why she's young yet.
Yeah. She prefers to have help and emotional support for sure.
Can I add a piece here? I want to talk about divorced families, right? Because that's actually when the questions come up the most for me. And it's the same thing. Whatever the cycle is that led to the separation and or divorce, that's the diabetes is going to sit there. So it's going to be about noticing the cycle. So often it's going to be one parent feeling resentful that the other parent isn't taking good care and isn't taking responsibility. So I hear often about situations where when, you know, child is with parent A, their numbers are totally in range. And then they go to parent B, who feeds them Danishes and doesn't dose enough, and they're totally out of range. And that is a really hard situation, because generally parent A, who's like on top of the management differently and has more numbers that are in range, is feeling massively stressed about what's happening over there at the other family's house. And so I think depending on where you are in your separation and or divorce, right? The question is how to get curious about what's happening. How is your personal cycle, relational cycle affecting management? And like, how do you come to some peaceful place with each other? I actually just gave a talk to divorced family. The mom who was in the room said that for a while, she and her ex only communicated over a Google Doc. Like, that's how they did it and how they could, because diabetes came to them after they were divorced, right? So there are all kinds of situations where you're having to navigate already a fragmented or fractured relationship, challenging relationship situation, right? And then diabetes folds in. So that's that. I just want to give a nod to those families.
Yeah, that would be incredibly difficult to navigate, in my opinion. So goodness.
It is.
Yeah. And I would have to imagine that, you know, whenever you go to make a suggestion to parent A or parent A is making a suggestion to you, it's hard not to feel attacked because you feel like they think you're doing everything wrong. So,
well, and certainly if that's the issue in the relationship already, where if the divorce happened in such a way that kind of a common narrative about what caused the separation and divorce, then that is more likely to be triggering. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That could probably be a whole series in and of itself right there. Okay, let's talk about strife between you as the parent and the child that is living with type 1 diabetes. Because I think a lot of times, and I hear about it mostly when kids start to get a little older and into the teen years, that a lot of times there can be a lot of strife between the parent and the kid because the parent wants what's best for the kid, obviously health and good health, safety. But sometimes that can come across very overbearing, lots of, I don't want to say nagging, but nagging, mm-hmm. really
I think that's fair.
Kind of being a helicopter parent in the world of diabetes, which, the kid can only imagine really start to resent and be angry about. So how would you what suggestions or tips do you have for families that might be experiencing that where the parent is just, they don't even have to be overbearing, but for whatever reason, the kid feels like they just want to be left alone. You know what I mean?
So again, I think that diabetes is sitting on the fault line, right? Mm-hmm. Because that none of what you're describing is atypical for some teens, right? Not all teens are like my diabetic son. My son with type 1 was not particularly like that. We had moments. My daughter, absolutely. We're just really struggling with that, right? But not massively around diabetes because I don't pick a fight there. So I think some of it is about, and you've had episodes on your show about relating to your teen kids. So I think some of it is about us educating ourselves about what to expect. I think some of it, us keeping relationship in the front. So what's the most forward piece? So I think for some families, if diabetes is the most forward piece, the kids feel it's like a wet blanket. It's like they have no more relationship with their parent because all they're doing is talking about diabetes. It doesn't make a lot of space. And so I really encourage parents to put the relationship first, which really is a task. Like if you're feeling anxious about diabetes and the fact that your kid didn't bolus at lunch or isn't seeming to take care of quote unquote anything. I really feel like most kids are taking care of something. And so it's helpful to find the place where you feel like your child is doing well. But I think that it's hard to see it when you're seeing poor time and range or high A1Cs or whatever it is. And so I think it's about keeping the relationship in the front, but also about knowing that the data is, and I feel like it, maybe I've talked about this already on here. I can't remember. The data really is that as kids hit their teens, their numbers get worse. And so it's not, the way I always say it is like, I'm not suggesting we unclip our seatbelts and we let our kids just do whatever. We obviously are there to keep them safe, but to not expect the same beautiful time in range or A1C, to know that it's a phase they're going through, to not panic, to keep sort of sounding the drumbeat of this is important for your health and safety. How can I help and support you? And keeping the relationship strong. And having confidence and faith that it's going to change. Because I believe for most kids, it does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. And I just want to a plug for your podcast right here, because, some people listening might be thinking gosh, I really wish they would hit on a specific thing within this realm of parents and their type 1 teens. But if you're living this right now, if you're living one of these scenarios that we're kind of talking through, get on Joanne's website, diabetessweettalk.com. And at the top of the page, there's a dark purple banner where you can submit your question, your specific scenario, your question. You can do it anonymously and You can be a guest on Joanne's podcast and she can answer your specific question. So do that.
Yeah. Thank you, Katie. Yeah. I think you're pointing to something important, not just my podcast, but thank you. But you're pointing to the fact that there's a lot of variability. And so I can say a lot of things about what you might see, but I can't really know what you're going to see. And so there are a lot of subtleties and nuances that we really want to think through. Actually, I volunteered at our local family camp, our area family camp last weekend. And there was a family that came and said to me, they had a 3-year-old, I think. And they were really worried about what was going to happen when he became a teenager. And I felt like, I don't know what kind of teenager he's going to be. Like, it's hard for me to help guide you, right? We need to look at the child who's in front of us. And that's true when they're teenagers too. But it's a little, you know, I can't give general advice other than keep listening, keep your child in the and your relationship in the forefront as much as you can. Right. Yeah. And then work on the diabetes piece.
Yeah. Chances are if they're coming to you with that question with their 3-year-old, then they probably have a three-nager on their hands.
Right. Yeah. Because those ages can be hard. I always felt like everyone said terrible twos. And for me, it was always the odd numbers were much harder than the even numbers.
Yeah. Three was tough for us too. 3 and 4, actually. I didn't feel like until we got to 5, things really calmed down. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm glad I will look upon those years fondly, but I'm glad we're past them also. Yes. All right. I wanted to say something. I can't speak to this a lot because Sarah is, I feel like we really haven't hit too many roadblocks in this area, but something that I try to do, some rules and boundaries that I have set for myself is that when she gets in the car after school, I try my best not to say anything about diabetes until later. I mean, you know, 20 minutes into the car ride, because we've got to like go get her brother from a different school. And I'll say, hey, sweetie, if you want a snack when we get home, you probably need to do your bolus for it now. I'll say that. But, you know, if there was like a crazy high during the day or like she just kept going low or whatever, I try not to really dissect any of that at all. I would say at least for a solid 30 minutes to an hour, but really even until later in the night. I mean, like maybe when I'm tucking into her bed and be like, hey, I was wondering, you know, this afternoon today, you know, you went up to 250 and that's not normally like a time that you would be eating or anything like that. That doesn't bother me, but I kind of need to know, like, did you eat something or maybe are your insulin needs different now at that time? Like, I just need to know the information so I can make treatment decisions. And I just find that if we, you know, just give her some room to breathe and whatnot when she gets home from school before I bring up any diabetes questions. And most of the time when I ask things like that, she's like, I don't know. And I'm
like, right. Okay.
Okay.
I think that that's common. But I also think, Katie, that you're talking about, I think you're 100% correct that that's a good thing to do. And you, as the parent, have to be more regulated on the inside to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So in addition to that, I want to name that we as the parents are the parents. So sometimes, even if we don't feel regulated on the inside, it's a fake it till you make it moment. And we have to try, right? Because what happens is we have emotional agitation that they were high at a time when we weren't expecting it, right? Or that you see that they didn't dose or I mean, for me, I can't stand it when she's bumping down in like 63, you know, and she comes up and then she goes down again, right? Like those are super agitating to me. So the question is, how do we contain our agitation enough to be able to do exactly what you're saying? And part of it is it's hard. And part of it is we're the parent, we have to. Right. We can't let our emotional life, the relationship with our kid. So even if we feel agitated, we have to somehow talk ourselves down and do exactly that. Like lead with how was the day? Who'd you eat lunch with? How was the special activity that you knew they were going to have, the field trip or whatever? And then later be like, hey, I wanted to check in about numbers because it looked like it was a little tricky here. Do you remember what happened? You know, just I want to be able to know so I can make the best adjustments on the back end. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, and I feel like with her pump too, there's really no reason that I ever need to ask her, what's your blood sugar? Because I can, I'm talking about our CGM now, but I can just look on the Dexcom and see what it, like, I don't need to interrogate her about that. And I also don't even need to interrogate her about like when she's in my presence, at least, and I can, you know, get the little controller that controls her Omnipod. I can look on there and see if she bolused for, you know, whatever that day. So I try to remember that too. Like, you know, again, if we had like a high blood sugar during the day or whatever, like unusually high after lunch, which I'm like, gosh, if she had done the insulin, we shouldn't have seen these numbers. You know what I mean? That type of thing. I don't have to ask her, hey, why didn't you bolus for lunch? Or, you know, it looks like I could just go on her controller and see, oh, she bolused. So I don't, you know, we can go from there. Like, or maybe she didn't bolus or whatever. So there's little things that I can do to, you know, only ask the questions that really need to be asked.
Yes. I think that that's a really good point. I think that because the technology is so changed, we have that option. And I make that mistake all the time of asking questions that I don't necessarily need to. And I think it puts too much diabetes in the mix. I also think that it's more work for us, right? Like my daughter's not an Omnipod. She's on a Tandem. So I can't look at it unless I'm up against her body. So she doesn't like that. But I could, if I were like more motivated and was having more conflict around it, I could download more regularly. Mm-hmm. I could just be like, when she's in the shower, grab the pump, download the data, take a quick look. So mm-hmm. I think it depends how much it feels conflictual, how much it feels burdensome in the relationship. Mm-hmm. And then you apply these strategies to try to take it out of the relationship as much as possible.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be proactive. It doesn't get too burdensome.
That's wise. I also think, though, Katie, that there's a message we tell ourselves that, like, we are teaching them, right? Mm-hmm. So this is another piece in the relationship, is that we feel the burden that we have to teach them because we like how to be good diabetes managers. But in the name of that, we can get a little punishing around the amount we're talking about it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, let's jump to siblings. I know that those poor other siblings can feel a little neglected sometimes when they're, you know, their brother or sister is getting all this attention around diabetes, especially in the beginning, you know, when it's all new and mom and dad are really honed in on what so-and-so is doing. And now there's this whole thing. I know even just a couple days ago, my youngest was trying to It was a little bit of a stressful night. Like, we had a late night, lots of activity going on, and I forgot that Sarah's Dexcom was going to expire. My husband was out of town for work. We got home, and anyway, long story short, Sarah wanted some privacy with the Dexcom change, and, you know, we needed to get it done. And but my other kid also had some questions and wanted me to quiz him on his spelling words and just blah, blah, blah. And anyway, it got to the point where it was like, I snapped a little bit, like, buddy, like, I just need you to leave me alone for a little bit. Like, Sarah needs some privacy. I will be out there in a little while to do your spelling with you. You know, the words I was saying were fine, but probably the tone I was saying them was not the best. I couldn't see on his face, you know, just this kind of like, okay, like, you know, like diabetes again, you know, takes the win. So what if a sibling is feeling very, I guess, out of the, I can't think of the word I'm trying to, you know, disgruntled a little bit about the whole diabetes situation.
Mm-hmm. So actually, I've done a webinar called The Other Sibling, which I don't think I have scheduled in 2023. But if folks are interested, you can sign up for my newsletter. You'll get the information about free webinars it's real. So it's a question I often ask 20-somethings if I'm interviewing them, like, what was your relationship, 20-somethings with type 1? Like, what was your relationship like with your sibling? And it can be really variable. Often there's a lot of support. Like, siblings often want to help. But what you're describing that happened with your son is also really real. And so I have two quick, easy suggestions. And then, of course, there are more complicated. But one is to really make time, right? Which is hard to impossible. I want to say, when my son was diagnosed, my daughter was 9 months old and I had a kid in the middle, right? And that kid in the middle, she really started coming unglued. And I know I said to her so many times, like, I know this is so hard for you, sweetie. I get it. You want to be taken care of. You know, you want to be babied, right? And I just am having trouble finding time. I messaged that a lot, but it didn't change anything for a long time. Like, it was just hard for her and hard for my relationship with her, honestly. And eventually, diabetes got a little quieter. My daughter got a little older. My baby daughter got a little older. And so I was able to pay attention. So some of it's knowing that it's hard, giving yourself some room, acknowledging that it's going to change at some point. But if you can, spending some time with that child. So that my middle child really needed time. And so I would carve out, you know, 10 minutes. I'm seriously 10 minutes to sit and read a book, sit and play trains, sit and do Barbie, sit and do whatever it is that child wants to do. Mm-hmm. The other thing is to really validate to them, like, that you see it. So when you go to your son to do the spelling words, to say, I know that diabetes can really get in the way. And I imagine that that's really hard for you. You know, that sort of validation model that we talked about a few episodes ago here is really something to apply there. They are struggling. Mm-hmm. That is real. And to name it and make as much space for their experience as they are needing, right? After the fact, like, in the emergency, you cannot do that. They have to come second, but to make space for it after. And also sometimes, like, it sounds like your son was like a little disgruntled, but not massively disgruntled. So sort of saying, yeah, it felt hard. And you're giving him some language about how it can feel like he gets sidelined. And you kind of want to do that so that he can express it to you when he's feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a good reminder about the validation piece. The validation episode was episode 89, I believe. So to go back and take a listen to that one, it was really good. Okay. Let's jump to, again, if you have a specific sibling question that has come to mind that we have shed some light on, get on Joanne's website and ask it. And you can have it answered by Joanne herself. Okay. So let's talk about just relationships. I think I've actually, one of your podcast episodes covered this a little bit, just relationships between like me and my friends. That can get strained because I feel like I like ghosted everybody for the first few months of Sarah's diagnosis. I mean, I was like, I could barely, you know, return phone calls or text messages, or, you know, I stopped going to the gym for a couple months. I mean, I just kind of fell off the face of the planet. And coming back from that, and, you know, I have some really good, wonderful friends in my life that were checking in on me, which I'm very fortunate. I know that I'm very fortunate to have, but, you know, it's just different. You know, it's just different because, you know, you now you're going out to dinner and you are trying to be very present and have a conversation with somebody, but you've got to check in on the numbers every now and then, or you might have to answer a phone call from your kid or your spouse or whatever. And I think that friendships can feel a little bit more strained under diabetes. So if, you know, or also, you know, your friends might not invite you along on things as much as they did before. Like if it's a family event and they feel like, oh, this might be really stressful for them because of diabetes, like they might not invite you to things like they would have before. What I have found though, and is I feel like Sarah doesn't get invited to as many things anymore, like sleepovers or things like that, you know, and I mean, she does, but it's just different. You know what I mean? I just feel like there's a hesitation there and that can be tricky to navigate.
Yep. I think everything you're saying is true. So as a parent, I feel like, I mean, you're talking about different moments. You're talking about post-diagnosis when you're in the thick of misery and learning curve and drinking from the fire hose, right? Because I think of post-diagnosis as drinking from a fire hose instead of a water bottle, even more sane. That you don't have the bandwidth to tend to your friendships. That is true. And so, and then when you pick back up, like who are the friends who can really be there? Who are the people who can listen to your story, who can understand what you're going through, who are flexible and accommodating and understanding, right? And there will be those people, I really believe. And there will be some people, I think, who, for whatever reason, can't manage. I don't think those are in the majority. Like on the podcast episode that I think you're referring to, the mom was asking the question, like she had had a fallout with a friend and she was wondering, is this something I should always expect? And I feel like, no, it's not my experience. It's not the experience I think of most people. And you are going to bump into some people who just somehow aren't flexible or aren't understanding. And I would chalk them up as like, not somebody who is would be a good friend to you right now. Like you're needing some understanding and compassion for what you're living in your family. And if somebody can meet you there, that gives you some good information about what the capacity is of that relationship. That's not an easy thing to do. It can be really painful. The other thing I'm thinking about is sort of in our house, we call it the suffering Olympics. I think there is a thing where, you know, you see it in, it's easy to identify in kids. It's sort of like, you know, I have so much homework. Oh yeah, I have so much homework. I was up till 1 o'clock in the morning, this kind of behavior. I think it can happen in adults too. Like I'm just so tired and worn out, right? That kind of thing. And I mean, I had a relationship with a woman who had a child with on the spectrum, and she was quite envious of the community support I got for having a child with diabetes. And it really blew our friendship up in a way where it became like a suffering Olympics competition. And I realized I could not be in relationship with her anymore, right? She actually said to me at one point, well, what would be the problem if your daughter ended up at the hospital? And I thought, okay, we're done, right? You're going to have some relationships like that. But I feel like mostly people want to help and want to understand. And so leaning into the places where you feel like you can. And I even sometimes might ask, like, can I describe to you what this is for me? Because I think that's fine to do. I do think that for our children, it is harder. For sure. That, you know, it's just harder to navigate a sleepover, for example. And it's not impossible, but we, the parents, have to trust the other parent, and that other parent has to feel safe enough and connected enough to us to want to take the risk and the responsibility, not really risk, but responsibility. So I think that that can be problematic, and we can help if we have relationships with our kids, friends, parents by saying, you know, are you willing to, like, pushing a little, like, would you be willing to, you know, and cultivating some more understanding in the parent community so that it feels safer for them to take our kids.
Yeah, definitely. I have to remind myself a lot too that, like, really and truly, people just don't understand it if they're not living it 24/7. And that's okay. Like, they don't have to understand every little detail and be in the trenches with you. Like, as long as they're willing to listen and offer some encouragement and, you know, hey, let's go grab a cup of coffee, you know, that's good enough, right? Mm-hmm. We probably shouldn't expect too much of our friends in the way of really understanding what goes on. Because, you know, I'm thinking of a couple situations. I have some really good friends right now that are going through extremely difficult situations that are totally different than diabetes. But, and I have no clue. I, you know, I can sympathize with them and I can lend an ear and be there when they need to talk, but I have no idea what they're really going through and what they're feeling inside. And I never will unless I'm living that same situation. So I think we need to remind ourselves too that, you know, it's certainly fine for us to be like, hey, can I describe this for you, what I'm feeling and what I'm going through? But at the same time, I just don't think it's really fair for us to really expect people to get it completely. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a reasonable perspective. I also think it's reasonable to hope that you have one or two people who get it completely because they're really listening. Like actually the person who took care of my kids in elementary and middle school, because I had, my kids went to the same school and they are 9 years apart, my type one kids, the same woman took care of both of them over years. And so she really understood. I will never forget where I was standing the moment where she turned to me and said, I don't know how you ever sleep. And I said, I don't. And I felt so seen, right, that she really understood how complicated the diabetes was because she was doing it during the day. And so I think there are some, and I have a very close friend who was always open to hearing. So she understands all the lingo. She speaks it. Actually, one of my favorite stories is another therapist in near me who had a close friend whose daughter was diagnosed, and she called her friend and said, how do I help and support you? And her friend said, you have to go learn this. For you to ask me to teach you when I barely understand what this is, if you really want to help and support me, you need to go learn what this is. And I thought that was incredible. And she did, right? She did. She went and learned
it. Really the more incredible part of that whole
story. All of it is incredible. Yeah. But this is to say, some people are open to that and we all deserve one of those people in our lives. So if you feel like you can cultivate it, do that too. Like, yes, expect that most people don't understand. Most people are compassionate and might say stupid things because they do. And right. And you're like, you kind of roll your eyes and think, yeah, that's not me. Actually, that's type 2 diabetes, or no, he can't eat the cake, or whatever it is. But to have one person who you feel like you really can explain it to, or more, if you're lucky, is important to cultivate.
Yes. I think you're right. It is important to have at least one or two. I have a good friend who her spouse is a type 1, but then her daughter got diagnosed with type 1 like a year after Sarah was diagnosed. And so, you know, neither of us want to be in this situation, but we're very grateful for our friendship because, I mean, talk about somebody. We were friends long before.
Lovely.
You know, we've been friends for 12 years or more. And now, you know, we just get it. You know, we go to church together and sometimes she'll have to get up and like leave the sanctuary and she'll just give me a nod. And I'm like, I know. You know what I mean? Like she's going to deal with some sort of diabetes related issue.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's just nice to have somebody who really, really, really gets it. And I really it wasn't really until her daughter was diagnosed that I think she got it because she was super hands off. You know, she's not managing it for her spouse. So she really was kind of in the dark until that all happened. But
yeah, I think that
there we
true.
Are.
Yeah. And it's, even though it's terrible, her daughter got it. It's so nice that you guys have each other. Right.
Yes.
And finding that person, if you're doing it through JDRF, if you're doing it at a camp, like I do think that if your community doesn't have that person that comes to the surface, go find them.
Yes. Right? Be weird, y'all. Just be weird and go hunt them down. I'm telling you.
I love the way you say that. It's so true.
Yes. I had a very, this is not diabetes related, but I had a very be weird moment. So my third child, bless his little precious heart, like he's just always been along for the ride with the older two. And so this year I promised myself, like, I'm going to invest in your friendships. You know what I mean? Like that you have at school. Cause usually it's like people are over for the other two and he's just kind of in the mix. Well, I was like, we're going to invest in your friendships this year. So I like sent him to school with a letter. To give to his friends, to give to their parents, like, because we go to a charter school, so we don't live in like the neighborhood with everybody that goes to school there, you know, it's not like the neighborhood school or whatever. And he, he did. And some of them contacted me and some of them didn't. But I'm like, I'm hunting down the people that didn't. So I like got in touch with the other people and we had a little play date and it was fun. But I emailed the teacher and I'm like, okay, I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but can you give me the email addresses of these other parents? Because I'm really making an attempt to invest in Timothy's friendships this year. And she was like, I mean, I guess I can ask for permission to give you their email. I'm like, yes, that's fine. Please support me in my weird endeavors. And she did. She actually just emailed me today with her email address.
You know what? I love that you're not daunted. And I love that you don't have some little dialogue going on in your head saying, this is too weird. I shouldn't do this. You know, I think you're doing exactly the right thing. And some of these folks might not respond warmly. And that's mm-hmm. fine, too. Like you're going to find the people who match your needs and Timothy's needs, and you're going to do that. And that's exactly what we all need to do, really, in all our relationships in some way. But with diabetes, mm-hmm. for sure. Right. Because it mm-hmm. can be so isolating. Mm-hmm. And that's parents' primary experience, I think, is the feeling isolated or one of their primary experiences. So I think it's so important to get connected.
Yes, absolutely. I talk about that a lot in my podcast. I think it's mm-hmm. so important. Okay. We've really talked about a lot. I feel like the last one we might want to touch on just a tiny bit is if you notice relationships changing for your child, like maybe they had a little bestie and now they're kind of growing apart after this. And I mean, who's to say it was really diabetes related? I mean, you know, when that thought comes to mind, I feel like the only thing that I could do was try to reach out to the parent to see what was going on there maybe. And it mm-hmm. depends on the age of the kid too. Like you probably mm-hmm. wouldn't want to interfere if they're a teenager and they're in, you know, middle school, high school, but what are your thoughts on that?
So that, you know, you'd sent me the questions in advance and I read that one and thought, I don't actually know of a situation where I've heard of that happening in the way that you're describing. What I do know of is teenage kids who feel nervous about telling their peers because they feel like they're going to be ostracized in some way. And so I hear about kids who are hiding diabetes because they don't, these are kids who are diagnosed later because it tends to happen, not always, but it tends to happen that kids who are diagnosed earlier are either in their community, so the kids, their peers know, or they're often more comfortable, like they're just more out about it. It's always been out, but definitely there are scenarios where teenagers won't want to say. And so they're sort of hiding it because they feel like they will be ostracized in some way. They will be othered in some way that's uncomfortable for them. Actually, there's someone who was just on my podcast who we talked about this because her son's in a really small school. He didn't want to say, but he feels like when he goes to college, he will say. And I've definitely seen that happen when I interview college students because it's a piece I do for my coaching courses. I do some interviews with college students and put it together as a panel so that parents can see what are the endpoints or one of the endpoints that we can look to. And I hear that kind of story. Like I wasn't comfortable and now I just think the tech is super cool and I'm really out with it. I'm fine. Like I think mm-hmm. that it, but I don't actually hear the story of like, you know, little Sally's best friend no longer will be friends with her because of diabetes. That story I haven't really heard.
Yeah. I'm sure it's out there somewhere, but yeah, I haven't heard that one. Luckily, all of Sarah's little friendships have stayed intact. You know, or if they haven't, it was because of some other natural reason, like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like they switched schools and it's just a lot to keep up with and all that. What I was going to say is that Sarah was 8 when she was diagnosed and she mm-hmm. was actually she did not want to tell anybody mm-hmm. about her diabetes. She didn't mm-hmm. want her device to be mm-hmm. seen. I mean, and you know, of course that broke my mama heart that she was kind of embarrassed or ashamed or nervous about telling other people about the diabetes. And I had to have a conversation with her of, sweetheart, I will never force you to tell. I said, your teachers need to know, you know, like adults that are taking care of you during the day need to know at school and church and whatnot or sports or whatever. But I will leave that up to you as to whether or not you want to tell your friends. Like that's completely your choice. I said, however, your life is going to be very challenging if you are always trying to hide mm-hmm. your diabetes. That's going to become very exhausting very quickly if you're always trying to hide it. So just keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. And where is she with it now, Katie?
Yeah, so she is better. I mean, it's not like she's shouting it from the rooftops. Mm-hmm. She has never wanted me to come into her class and do mm-hmm. like a little presentation. Mm-hmm. I know some people do that and their kids absolutely love it. She would rather die, honestly, than have mm-hmm. me. mm-hmm. But she's much more willing to, she came home from school one day, she's in fifth grade, and she said, I told a couple people about my diabetes. And I was like, oh, that's wonderful. What did they say? And she was like, they were just kind of like, oh, okay. You know, younger kids are so nice and full of grace for the most part. But, and she's more willing to wear, you know, she doesn't really care about it being seen anymore. You know, she'll put it on a place on her thigh or her arm where the shirt won't cover it or whatever. It doesn't seem to be as big of an issue. She still doesn't want to lead with that, you know, or shout it from the rooftops, but it seems like she's much more willing to talk about it. Yeah. Or if somebody asks like, what's that, you know, on her arm. And 'cause I had to tell her that too. I'm like, sweetheart, you know, kids, if they're asking you questions, they are not making fun of you. Like 99.9% of the time, they're just curious. They've never seen that before and they don't know what it is and they want to know. So if they're staring at it or asking questions, they're really just curious. So just tell them it's my insulin pump or it's my blood glucose monitor. And if they say, oh, and skip away, then that's fine. Or if they have more questions, you can do your best to answer those. But so I had to talk to her about that too.
Yeah, that's a lovely way to handle it. I think that most kids, even, I mean, you're saying young kids, but I think even teenage kids, they don't know what it means. So you say, oh yeah, I have type 1 diabetes, and it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. And like, I know kids, young adults who as kids would play games with their friends, like, let's guess the blood sugar. Whoever's closest wins the prize, you know, whatever. And there's no actual prize, just wins the, like, you know. But I think that, you know, there are ways, they don't actually know what it means for the person living it. And so this idea that our kids have about shame and about separating themselves is, it's inside them. It, for the most part, you're right, Katie, when people are saying, what's that? They're not saying, ew, what's that? They're saying, what's that? Like, I don't know what that is. And they're just trying to understand something. Yeah.
Okay. I think we should probably stop here unless there's something burning that you want to say.
Other than thank you so much for having me on the show. I have enjoyed it so much.
Oh my gosh, you're so welcome. Yeah, I will definitely be keeping in touch with you. I know we've already chatted about that before we started recording, but I've really loved it. It's been great. And the feedback from listeners, I know I've sent you a message or two, but the feedback from listeners has been fantastic. They've been loving it too. So thank you.
You're so welcome. Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Katie.
All right. Thank you so much for listening today. That is it for our episode. Again, make sure you check out those show notes. I will leave links to other episodes that I've done with Joanne, along with a link to Joanne's website, diabetessweettalk.com. And there you can find all of the wonderful things that Joanne has to offer for the type 1 community. All right, my friend, have a fabulous week, and I will chat with you soon. Until then, stay calm and bolus on. Bye.